This podcast is brought to you by Shout Engine. In less than 5 minutes, you can start your own podcast for free with ShoutEngine.com.
Okay, live for the final time this week from SEMA 2018. We are in the MAGNAFLOW booth, and today I've got the gentleman from Essex Racing?
Essex Parts Services,
okay.
Yep.
Okay. Excuse my faux pas.
No worry. Because there actually is an Essex Racing, and there was an Essex Racing. That's kind of how we came to be started as a racing team. Did 24 hours of Daytona, yeah. A lot of sports car stuff back in the 70s and 80s, and then it morphed into a parts business.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of SCCA and NASA.
Yeah, well. Because you guys, I mean, let's start out there. I mean, you guys are not exactly new around this stuff.
No, I mean, we've been around for 30 plus years now. Yeah. And servicing, helping out, you know, racers anywhere from your regional club racers all the way up to NASCAR, Cup teams, IndyCar teams, sports car teams, all the way, Hendrix and Ray Hall, Letterman, Lattering, and those teams all the way down to,
that's kind of what you guys got famous for, was providing for that stuff, right?
Yeah. And, you know, about, 15 years ago, we really kind of focused in on the NASCAR, NASCAR brake systems, because they were having a lot of trouble at the road courses and short tracks, and really kind of honed in on brake systems.
You mean those guys actually use their brakes?
A little bit, certain times.
A little bit,
yeah. And they decided that they have to keep a little tiny mini wheel on it, so we have to shove a lot of brake into a little 15-inch diameter.
I'll be completely transparent. I have made fun of NASCAR many, many times, but I do understand that there is a lot of engineering, and those cars get the shit kicked out of them and really do need some quality components like that. I make fun just because the oval track just
turn left, turn left, turn
yeah.
left.
Yeah, turn left. The thing is, I am a big fan of rally and of road course, and
the best thing that NASCAR has done over the years is they've progressively tried to add more road racing.
Yeah, which I do appreciate.
And that they draw the crowds. This year was the first year of the Roval at Charlotte, and it was one of the best races I've watched in the last, I don't know, 5 years plus. Yeah. I mean, it's great. It brings the crowds, and you want to see them use some equipment. Go to a road race, and it's unreal.
Yeah, well, I mean, and those cars aren't as light as some of the other stuff that's out there. I mean, what is NASCAR chassis weighing in at these days?
About 3,400 pounds. Yeah,
that's heavy by race car standards.
And the bigger problem is that they're running around on tiny little skinny tires. Everybody thinks that they have these massive rubber underneath, and they don't. They're little tiny 8-inch or 9-inch tires.
Eight and a half, and it's
so there's not a lot of grip there, and that actually makes brakes even harder because you have to be under a brake event a lot longer.
Right.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, they're running slicks, and that's nice. So, I mean, that makes up for some of the tire width difference, but still, I mean, that's a lot of stress.
I've never driven one, but
they get used too.
Yeah, those road courses must be hell for the chassis engineers to set up because they're so different than everything else. Because I'd have to imagine that those cars could potentially be prone to understeer with the regular setup.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, it's 40-year-old truck suspension in basic design. It's been engineered to death, but
I don't know that they're really going to get that much better than they are now. I mean, it's probably incremental upgrades here and there.
You go watch what they do at Watkins Glen, and it's unreal. I mean, the way they keep the cars pointed in the way they want them to go, and they just keep peeling off quicker lap after quicker lap after quicker lap, and you just see the equipment get used up.
It's definitely a different aspect of racing. But outside of the NASCAR realm, where are you guys really seeing your products being picked up?
What we're here for at SEMA mostly is our what we call our competition brake systems. And so being the AP Racing importer and distributor, we had access to a lot of competition parts. Yep. But we noticed nobody was really producing systems that were specifically geared towards track use.
I could think of one other company, but that's
they were there.
You guys are much more focused.
We are, and that we don't. You know, that's just what we do. We've always done, and we wanted to be able to apply our knowledge that we got in NASCAR and in sports car racing at the highest levels, and apply those principles towards brake systems that anybody could buy for their Corvette or BMW. Yep. that they wanted to track, because there wasn't any. Honestly, even AP to a certain extent weren't really using a lot of the technology that we were using in the Pro Series for their competition and their road-based kits. And we're like, well, why not?
If my memory serves me correct, you guys are you the exclusive AP distributor in the U.S.?
For all of their competition products.
Yeah.
So anything that's racing-based comes through Essex.
Yeah. And then you guys are out of the rally area, right?
Right outside of Charlotte.
Charlotte.
Yeah, I mean, not far from the rally area. And another thing about what we're doing and why we're here at SEMA with our competition brake systems. When we decided to go down that road, we didn't want to just unload brake systems to every single market out there. We wanted to really tackle the racers, the weekend guys that are taking the specific vehicles that we're catering to, going to the track, and really hammering down on them. We didn't want to have something available for everything that was out there. You know, we wanted to have more of a specific market with the specifics in mind.
Well, let's be honest. I mean, there are certain cars that are much more apt to be used on track stuff. Yep. You know, you've got your Miatas, your Vets, your 911s, your Vipers, Camaros, Mustangs.
M3s.
Yeah. The M3 market's a big market for us.
But outside of that stuff, there's not a whole hell of a lot you regularly see track use on.
Now, you kind of start to see the same things once you go to different track events, different track organizations that put on different track weekends. You go to this track and you start to see the same kind of lineup. You have your E36, E46, E90, F80, all the M3s. You have C5, C6, C7 Corvettes, the 911s,
and the nice thing is with all those various cars, the evolution of them leaves a lot of the steering knuckles and all the brake points very, very similar, not exactly
a crossover.
That's what I love about, that's one thing I really like about the BMWs, is that you can oftentimes get the brakes off the new one and slap it on the old one.
That's exactly.
we do that. I'm the product manager, so I deal with engineering as well as sales. And what we always want to maximize our wheel fitment.
Yep.
So even though they might bolt up, if we can gain a couple millimeters of extra caliper clearance, a lot of times we're just going to start from scratch, clean sheet, new kit, new adapter parts, everything from scratch, just to get that little extra bit of clearance.
Yeah, which is different than some of the other guys that are in this field, where you know they like to just build one caliper setup and try and just cram it into as many things as possible. Yeah. Which I get from a cost basis standpoint, but like you guys are very specifically focused.
Yeah, we have the specific focus of track use, so we understand that someone's going to try to do the tightest wheel package that they can get with the proper clearance. They want to run an 18. They want to have that ability.
Race cars should have 18s.
Right. And
period.
If we can help them do that, and give them the best fitment possible to make that work, then that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, it's a very confusing market for people that don't understand some of the finer points of it. Like, there are a couple of brake manufacturers that are very prevalent in terms of, you know, magazine advertising and stuff like that, that I've seen many, many failures of the calipers on, and it's goddamn terrifying.
Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah.
They look cool, but they don't have that same kind of rigorous engineering that like an AP caliper does.
One of the things that we see most often with our customers is that the realization that, you know, even modern cars with the brake systems that are coming on it that are pretty good, a lot of them, I mean, we've had it even from high-end OE manufacturer engineers where they drove the last generation car and, you know, how could you possibly get any better than that? It was great.
Right.
We had wonderful brakes in the old car. And then they put our stuff on, and it blows their mind. Like, I can't believe that it's that much different.
Yeah, I mean, and even going from a really nice OEM setup, I mean, like, you can go from, you know, even something as nice as the stock calipers on like a Z06 or something like that, there's a big improvement to be made when you go over to a track package.
It's big. I mean, the biggest thing that you can get from a brake package upgrade, suspension packaging upgrades when you go to the track is anytime you can get better confidence on track.
Yep.
I mean, once you lose confidence, it's really, really, really hard to get that back.
Yeah.
And if we can bring them a product that immediately they have to sit here and think, man, the pedal's a lot different, that confidence that they gain from that, that's what we're trying to go for.
Yeah. It's funny, and I'm sure you guys preach this all the time. It's just like tires, suspension, brakes before you do anything else.
Yeah.
Power should be the last thing you do.
And it's not.
And it's often the very first thing everybody does.
Yeah, well, it's the one that's the most immediate gratification.
It is. We're all junkies. We want to go fast. That's part of it. And it's usually not until you have that Code Brown moment that you go, oh, I need better brakes.
Yeah.
You know, it usually takes one of those moments to really solidify that decision.
Oh, I've had that moment many times in my Corvette.
Yeah.
Which is why right now, that's why I'm looking at brake packages, because it's just like, The stock PBR calipers on the C6 are fucking garbage, to be very blunt. You know that, and I do love how GM decided to save a couple of pennies by doing the same rotor on both sides of the car.
Yeah, that was an interesting revelation for sure when we first saw that, where they made a directional vane disc.
So the passenger side always warps like instantly.
Just, it probably runs 300-400 degrees hotter than the other side.
Moronic move. I don't think that would happen with the current Corvette program.
No.
But back in that era, I mean, it was just the accountants still had a stranglehold over it.
It was always surprising because that car was so capable. You know, that was one of the really first cars to come out of an OE manufacturer that was really, I mean, very, very, very capable car. Almost scary. You know, that's the thing that we're seeing now is every car that comes out.
They're unreal.
So capable.
You go to the track and you see what a C5 Z06 will do around VIR, and you're like, man, that guy is—he's cooking. He's giving it everything. And then you go see a C7 Grand Sport, and you put a proper driver, and it's unreal. And you have people that are going to these track events that they are doing everything they can to drive as fast as they can, and they have not done anything to the car. They're running OE brake fluid. They're running OE brake pads. They're OE brake lines. They haven't done a thing, and they wonder why after one lap they don't have a pedal.
Right.
You know, and it's...
So you said a magic couple of words there that I'm very curious about, because I understand enough of the engineering that in most circumstances it's fine, but brake lines.
Yep.
How much credence is there in going to a braided line for most applications? I've heard it both ways. I've heard that it's bullshit, that a hydraulic line is more pressure than a human's ever going to be able to put on it and tell the difference anyway. And then there's also the argument that, you know, you get better brake feel with the braided line. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's always, in a brake system, the best thing you can do is going to be to remove any compliance in the system, any flex. Any flex is going to immediately transfer back to the pedal, and it's going to create additional... it's a time delay. It's a time delay between the time your foot hits the pedal and time the brakes activate. And anytime you can remove compliance from the brake system, it's gonna translate back into a better braking system. That goes for the caliper. Brake pads have a lot of compliance too. So brake pads can all act differently and feel differently.
Yeah, brake pads are actually a little spongy.
They can be, definitely. And it's pretty amazing. Sometimes you can feel the difference between just one set and another, and how much the pedal feel is there.
Yeah.
Now, on a braided line, basically, you're taking a rubber line. It's reinforced rubber. I mean, it's a hydraulic line.
It's heavy.
But you're translating, especially on a boosted system. You're putting 1,000 psi in through the brake system, so it's still going to swell. It's still going to expand. And even a Teflon stainless braided line will have some compliance, but it's going to be less than a rubber line. Is that going to be an immediate feel, particularly on an OE system that's got a big brake booster on it?
Right.
Probably not. On a pedal box car with twin masters,
on a race car, if you're doing it, you may as well do it right.
It's going
to... I'm really talking more about like the average guy that takes his Mustang or his Camaro out on the weekend, and
I wonder if it's, I don't know yet.
I think with an opposing piston caliper, a typical Brembo style caliper, as you're seeing on so many cars, that would probably have better reaction to a stainless braided line than, say, a pin slider caliper.
Right.
Because a pin slider, I mean, you bleed a brake system with a pin slider caliper, and you can see that caliper moving. So a braided line is not really going to I mean, it's going to remove compliance, but you're never going to feel it because there's so much more compliance
elsewhere. So much other slop in the system.
Exactly, right. Exactly.
We get a lot of customers that go to the track and may call us for brake package upgrades for a application that we may not offer a full brake kit for. Mm-hmm. So if we tell them, look, we don't have this, but start off by doing stainless steel brake lines, get a proper brake fluid, and make sure you have proper brake pads for that track weekend, that translates to a lot when they're on track versus what they've done previously.
And then call us back if it's still not working,
right,
and we can figure something out.
And we definitely want to help them with that. It's just trying to bridge that gap and let them know, look, there's things that you can do that aren't over the top to make it.
Yeah, the top. Right. Honestly, pads and fluid are going to be your two largest initial purchases for a better brake system.
And if you've got shitty rotors, a good set of rotors as well.
Yeah.
When I say shitty rotors, like my C6 situation with the factory rotors that were on it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, they're useless.
If you can have a rotor that's directional vane, that's gonna cool better. Yeah. Anytime you can get heat out of the system more efficiently, it's going to be a better brake system.
I have a feeling I know where you're going to go with this already because I have studied it quite a bit. Can you educate our listeners on drilled rotors, please?
It was kind of one of those Band-Aid fixes back in the, I guess, 70s and 80s.
Largely for off-gassing when you had asbestos,
pads were an organic, they had organic binders in them. And when you heated them up to brake temperatures that you saw in a racing system, they would actually off-gas a little bit. They would burn up and the resins would,
for lack of a better term, give you a hovercraft effect on the hub.
Essentially, put a layer of gas in between the rotor and the pad, and then you wouldn't have any brakes. So they drilled the holes to try to let some of that gas out. Now, early 90s, brake pad materials basically changed wholesale.
Mm-hmm.
The way pads were made, what they were made with, changed dramatically in that time, and they don't off gas anymore. Not in any real sense at all. So what the problem with the drilled rotor now is that because the temperatures that you're seeing in a brake system, they create stress risers.
Mm-hmm.
So, when that disc is expanding because of the heat, it's going to crack at the first stress riser it comes to, which is going to be a nice big hole.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a grid of nice big holes
all the way across your disc. So, they're still making them.
I can't believe that people still make them.
I'm a little surprised, specifically on the OE side. The OE manufacturers that produce sports cars that are high-end, I'm still surprised to see it.
I think BMW is drilling their rotors right now, and it's ridiculous. But people, associate it with performance.
Yeah.
But you guys are big on slotted setups, right?
Yeah. I mean, every real racing disc is probably going to have a slot in it.
Right.
And the reason for that is mostly for bite.
Keeps a fresh edge on the pad, right?
Keeps a fresh edge on the pad, but it also creates an edge that a pad can bite to.
Yeah.
So it's a misnomer. People, it actually adds heat to the disc. It actually increases the surface temperature of the disc because you have more edges that are being
hit. Friction.
More friction.
Yeah.
And it's more edges on the disc that are being hit by the brake pad. So you're actually creating a little bit higher temperatures by going with a slot.
Theory. I mean, it's more surface area, right?
Mm. Right.
So it's one of those ones that I always want to clear up when I've got somebody that's actually an authority on it, because there's just so much misconception, about that kind of stuff. And I see people buy them, and I'm like, oh, that's actually kind of a safety hazard at a certain point.
If you're out tracking it and get them hot and cycling them that much, it's gonna.
You know what? You can even do that in the canyons out in California. You can brake cycle. I mean, the second week I had my Fiesta ST. I lit the brakes on fire going down the hills and canyons there, so it could be done, it could be done.
He's proven it.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it myself, and I'm not the only, I'm not saying that I'm unique in that regard. I've seen it multiple times.
Right.
It's, those are some serious hills there.
It goes back to the factory OE equipment. I mean, everyone will look at a factory setup and they think that it's apt to take whatever they're going to throw at it when it's not. I mean, especially if you're going to do canyon runs or even if you go do a light duty track day, autocross, there's equipment that it's not designed for that. It's the calipers, the rotors, the pads that are on there OE-wise, they're just not designed to take that abuse.
Well, their parameters are, got to slow the car from stop once.
Right.
Yeah.
or twice, maybe.
Maybe, you know, maybe run them, you know, if you're new to the track and you're just feeling it out, you're not going to destroy them completely, you know, with one track day. And I wouldn't advocate somebody going and spending a bunch of money if they don't know if they like it or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
But if you start getting into it, you know.
That's why it's a benefit for most track day weekends that you go to. They have parade laps. They have learning laps. They have lead and follow laps that you can go out there.
SCCA does a track night too.
You go out there. You're not out there driving at 10/10, you know.
Shouldn't be.
Right. Exactly. You're going out there and you're being very, very lax about it, and you're learning how everything works, and then you start to, you know, go at a click quicker, and then you just you progress, yeah. And you progress with you know your lap times, and then your car progresses with, you know, upgrades.
Well, you bring up, you know, certain misnomers and misinformation in our industry, and you know the one thing that we get is you know, will make my car stop shorter. No, and that's not really what we do. What it is going to, you know, you're always traction limited.
It goes back to that confidence.
It's not the goal,
right? You're traction limited by the tires. The tires will be your ultimate limit on how fast you can slow the car down. What we want to focus on is consistency and repeatability.
Yep.
We want you to know that every time you go to hit the brakes, they're going to react the same way, in the same fashion, every time you go to the corner.
There's nothing worse than hitting your brakes and just right to the floor.
Right.
Right.
And another thing to add on, you know, consistency is also consumability too. When you go to a track event and you're just burning through OE pads and OE rotors, like you said on the Corvette, I mean, the rotors, they're only designed to take this much. And if you go to the streets of Willow for a full weekend, you're way past that point.
Oh, yeah.
And once you swap to the correct, you know, utilities for the track, you get more out of it. You get more life out of it. You're keeping temperatures cooler. It's just becoming more efficient.
Yeah, and then, you know, to that point, the consumables is, you know, you got the two-piece rotors, and it becomes a whole different game as far as replacing things. I mean, what would you, if versus a conventional rotor where it's the full hat and everything's integrated, what's the primary difference in terms of the economics of going to a two-piece like that?
It depends on application. So the biggest advantage of a two-piece fully floating disc assembly is, as it heats up, it expands, and when you have a fully floating two-piece disc assembly, you don't have to worry about anything binding up and cracking. When you have a typical OE-style all-in-one rotor, once it gets up to a certain temperature, there's nothing for it to do except give way.
Right.
So.
Well, and I get to that just because I've seen issues where, you know, especially with some of the high-end stuff now that comes with carbon rotors, you know, your GT3s and, you know, your ZR1s and stuff like that, it's somewhat popular for the track rats to go to a two-piece setup because those factory rotors are $15,000 or $18,000.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. I mean, you take delivery of your 991 GT3 with carbon ceramics and you go to...
And they're great.
They're great for what their intended purpose is. And then you go and you destroy them. And you call your Porsche dealer and you say, hey, this is what I need. And he hits you with a bill and it makes your head spin. And then you look at what it is for a two-piece disc assembly from us and the proper pads for it. It's, I mean, a fraction of what you pay, and it's going to last and give you the performance that you want. And it has the right, you know, products for what we're doing.
Is in that section of the market where you've already got really high-end calipers that are shipping on the cars, do you ever just tell the customers, hey, just leave the calipers alone and just go to the rotors and pads and you should be good for what you're doing? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Sometimes. I mean, the calipers are getting better. They're getting stiffer, but they're still pretty heavy.
Yes, that is true. Absolutely true.
It is still an OE product. It is still, you know, a part of the accounting department at an OE manufacturer,
right.
But you know, there are times where that it's a good economical way to get most of the way there.
Right.
The performance, the ability to lower your disc temperatures, to keep your the heat from getting too hot, and that's going to lower your consumable costs. Mm-hmm. Your pads will last longer, your disc will last longer, everything will run smoother, you won't burn things up so much. It is a good stepping stone.
Maybe for the guy that's, you know, goes out once a month or something like that, it'd be
right,
fine.
You know, half a dozen times a year, no reason, you know. I'm not going to always advocate a brake system is the best way to go for a casual user.
Right.
We do are the guys that are out there every other
weekends.
Yeah.
Or even us guys that live around L.A. where we hit the canyons and we can go beat on our cars every weekend.
Another thing to that effect, too, is an OE brake caliper replacement pads for them. You're limited to what is available.
Yeah.
You know, you may not have the pad choice, pad compound, pad manufacturer that you want in an OE shape. When you switch to a competition brake kit that is a very common pad shape that's commonly used for competition use, the type of pads that you want are generally available. I mean, it's a common pad shape. They're thicker pads. All helps to increase the longevity of the use of it.
Right. And that was actually you hit my question on that one before I even got to it. Is, you know, what is the pad, you know, what's the experience of buying pads and being able, the options for them when you actually move up to a system like yours?
It really all goes back to what the car is used for. We have some customers that the minute they go buy their C7 Grand Sport, they take it home, they pull everything off, they put a full kit on it, they put Hoosiers on it, and they put it in the trailer, and then they unloaded it whatever track they go to. And for that, they may have one specific pad that they really like. We also have the customers that dual purpose the car. They autocross it.
And that's like a guy like me.
Right.
You know, it sees – that car sees about 80% normal street use.
Right.
And then the other 20% is, you know, illegal or on a track.
See, you know? And you know, a lot of those times it's just as simple as swapping pads for what you're doing. You know, we have – I mean, I know you guys have seen it. We've all seen it who are in the industry. You come to SEMA and you see how much the Optima Ultimate Street Car Challenge has grown. Mm-hmm. The good guys.
There are a lot of cars out there this year.
It's unreal. Yeah. And I think – I mean, I may not be 100% right, but I think the only rule – that you have to have to, you know, compete in that is you have to run a 200 tread wear tire. And I think that's it. So you have guys that are doing above and beyond of the car. They're going to put the brake kits on the car. They're going to run, you know, more of a racing style wheel. And then you have the guys who don't really touch it, you know, and it goes both ways. But if you go this way, you have more options to run the pads that you want. And it really all comes together.
Yeah, it's just the options that are available when you move
right
up to it. It's just crazy how limited you are on the OE stuff, and you don't even know that most of the time.
Right.
Well, and in certain applications for aftermarket too, there are several aftermarket brake companies that like to make a proprietary pad shape.
Yeah.
We don't want to work on that because we know everybody likes, you know, brake pad compounds are like ice cream. Everybody's got their flavor.
Yeah.
And we understand that, and we're not pushing it. We just want it. We use very standard race shapes, been around for decades.
A big misconception, too, is they don't understand how much look at the Corvette market. Historically, a very common
brake
pad.
Which is one of your big sellers.
Right, right. I mean, historically, a very common brake pad for Corvette guys have been a Hawk DTC60, a Hawk DTC70. It's a very popular pad, and it's been around for a really long time.
Big improvement over OE.
Right.
You know.
And then they move up to, say, a C7 Z06, and they call us and say, hey, I want this pad for my OE caliper. Well, they're calling to get a fully dedicated racing pad for an OE caliper, and they hear the price. And they're like, really? Because it's expensive. And you look at that same pad in a very common pad shape for a aftermarket racing caliper, a lot of the times it's cheaper. And that's one of the things that they just can't grasp. They say, how can this be cheaper when it's racing and when it's different than OE? It's, you know, OE pads, they weren't designed to be made in a DTC 70 compound.
Yeah. And you know, track days, really, when it comes down to it, it's all about spending money and consumable items.
Right.
That's the thing that people don't realize is, you know, it's the tires and the brakes that are the expensive part of racing.
Yep.
Like the entry, the $100 or $200 that you pay to get in for the day is the cheap part of it. Mm-hmm. When you're blowing through the set of tires every month and a set of brakes, you know, it's interesting. So when you guys don't have an application that already exists for a given model or a group of models, how long does it usually take for you to get the caliper adapters and everything made for something like that?
So basically, we'll bring a car in. We'll have our engineering staff. We'll pull it apart, put it on our CMM, take very detailed measurements of the application. We'll look at things like pad centerline. We'll look at the hydraulic side of it on the caliper side, measure piston area, that sort of thing, and we'll determine whether we have a product that can go on the car within a certain percentage of the factory brake bias, because we don't want to change the front and rear brake bias of the car.
Well, ABS gets upset, and
it does it does weird things.
Traction control systems can get squirrely.
So we try to match the factory hydraulics as much as possible, even if it's not quite where we would think it should be. We still try to match it because we understand that the OEs have electronics now that kind of, you know, take care of a lot of those things.
Oh, yeah, I mean, my Fiesta uses its brakes as a diff, as basically an LSD.
Yeah, well, and we had actually a lot of problems with the Focus when we first started putting kits on that, because they were doing vectoring out of a corner. Like, why am I brake squealing when I'm flat footing out of a corner?
You burn through brakes on those cars fast.
Yeah.
So the stock ones are excellent for what they are, but like, you burn through them fast.
Yeah.
So we get the measurements we need. Usually take a couple days. After that, we'll machine up some prototypes.
Yep.
That usually takes a couple weeks to get the prototypes made, get the car back in, test fit the prototypes, make some small adjustments. You know, it's pretty rare that we could nail it on the first try. You know?
Oh, yeah.
We're talking thousands, you know, here or there. You know, we move things around a little bit.
And you get the advent now of at least 3D printing, so you can do it in nylon beforehand and see if it...
We work with some of that. Nylon's a little hard to work with because it does have more flex in it than an aluminum would.
Yeah.
So we still prefer to prototype in aluminum just for the rigidity, because if things move around, you know, our clearances are in the thousands. We don't have a lot of room to have much flex. So we have to make sure that we're pretty much on the money every time we do it. And we've messed with the 3Ds a couple times, and it works for certain things and not others.
Now what you guys need is the sintered metal one, but those are a little pricey.
That's getting up
there.
That gets
up there.
Yeah, I got a friend that's out of their shop. They're doing turbo impellers with those now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the 3D printing with aluminum and titanium, it's going to change the industry down the road.
Well, additive manufacturing is just so much more economical than sitting there and machining out of a piece of billet. So much less waste.
Yeah. Big time.
So, and then once we get done the prototypes, get the test fit, usually about 4 to 6 weeks on production.
That's pretty fast turnaround.
So figure 3 months start to finish.
Okay, so
12 weeks.
What do you have out now? What's kind of the big stuff, the most common stuff that you guys are selling a lot of, and that most of the enthusiast market would be like shooting for as far as supported models go?
Depending on where you are and what is popular in that area. I mean, we've always been popular in the Corvette market.
Right.
We've always been popular in the BMW market, the E36, the E46, the E90, and the F80. But now, I mean, we have seen a huge tilt in the Porsche market, the GT3 market.
Yep.
When we first started doing the brake kits, we had two or three brake kits that we had a Evo 789, an
Which
STI.
Makes all the sense in the world.
And an E36 M3. That was our first three brake kits. Yeah. And now we're over 110 applications. Yeah. So, I mean, we're going where they're needed. But, I mean, we've gone from those kits to now we're releasing a McLaren 720 kit. We have the 991 GT3 GT4 kit. And, I mean, it's kind of, spreading to that side now, but I mean, Corvette market is that's bread and butter for us. I mean, we have a really good relationship with the guys at NCM. We do a lot of events with them. I mean, and it's funny, when we first started doing the track day kits, I'd go to an event and there'd be 70 cars there, and I'd see maybe one or two cars with the older AP stuff on it.
Right.
You know, and now I go to an event and it's you know a quarter of the field, and that's from 5 years ago to now. That's a huge jump.
It's got
to
be a little bit of a proud moment. You go like, hey, we did this in short order.
Yeah.
And 3-4 years. Yeah.
Well, I remember when the vet, when you guys first started offering the vet packages and stuff, and that's when I stumbled on you. Probably I don't even know how many years ago. And it's just like, oh, here's an option.
Yeah.
So,
you know, it's been interesting. You know, the AP brand in North America, anyways, has actually been relatively undersold for
a long
decade.
Time.
Yeah.
I think just in the last 5 or 6 years, the brand recognition has really jumped up.
Yeah. I mean, the racing, the hardcore racing circle has always known it.
Right.
The enthusiast market.
The enthusiast
really
market. The HPDE. You know, that's where we've seen so much growth because, like Ryan said, up until, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, it wasn't, they weren't aware.
So is there a goal to get an OEM contract in here at some point?
Well, because we're competition.
Yeah.
OEM contracts are hard to come by.
Yeah.
We were lucky enough to work with Ford on their FP350S project.
Mm-hmm.
So they, you know, they built that factory track car out of it's a GT350 body with a 5.2 Coyote motor, basically.
Right.
So we were lucky enough. We sent our engineers up there to work with their engineers to come up with a brake system, brake package for that car. So that was actually our first major OE project, and it worked out well. The engineers and the drivers of that car were extremely happy with the brake system, and you know, we were more than proud to be able
like a
to.
Sounds like a nice start.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's you know. We get in there, and we've recently worked a little bit with Honda, the Civic Type R, and those guys. And unfortunately, you know, politics and certain sanctioning body rules kind of prevent some things from happening, even though they don't.
I won't put the words in your mouth, but I, you know, doing business with Japanese companies can be a little particular sometimes.
Well, you know, they actually really liked the product. It wasn't even them. They really wanted to run the system on their car.
Yeah.
It was the sanction body that came back and said, no,
oh, that's what it was.
It's got two extra pistons and you can't run that.
Yeah.
And my experience in the past has just been, you know, they like to do things a very certain way.
Right. Yeah. And so when they come to us and they're actually happy with us, it makes us feel even better because we know how.
We know they wanted it. They just couldn't have it.
Yeah.
And we know that they scrutinize things even to more of a degree than most.
Yeah.
And like going back to what you said, kind of the pat on the back, it's a huge difference from going to seeing the onesies and twosies at the track events to seeing the 54 cars that Ford produced that has our product on it when they get to that customer. And I mean, it's been a big jump, and I mean, we're definitely excited about it.
We're a building full of car geeks. You know, we're all car guys. We, you know, I think at one point I did the math. It was well over 150 years of motorsports experience in our building. We only have 20 some odd employees, so it's, you know, we've all been doing it. We've all been doing it a long time, but we love the stories. You know, if any of our customers are listening, give us a call. Tell us what you did with our products. You know, we love hearing the stories that, hey man, I went out and set my fastest lap time by 2 seconds, not even, you know, the only thing I changed was, you know, that stuff. Is we eat that stuff up. Send us an email, send us pictures. We love that stuff.
You know what is I'll do what I can to help you guys spread the word on this stuff a little bit.
Perfect. We
because,
appreciate that.
I'm friends with a lot of these YouTube people and all that stuff, so we can get you some more featured. I can make some introductions.
I'm not, you know, we're both pretty we like the sound of our own voices, so I guess we're more than happy to talk with anybody about anything that racing, you know, in general, all the way down to our brake products.
So where can everybody find all this info on Essex and the AP, all the AP stuff you guys move?
Our website's probably the best place.
Okay.
EssexParts.com.
Social media. I mean, nowadays social media is the big thing too, of course. So we're actively on Facebook, Instagram. I mean, we've been, you know, doing some live streams from the show here. We make sure we post as much as we can when we go to different track events. So, I mean, best contact source would be the website, the EssexParts.com.
I say that because a lot of times people are impressed with the amount of information and knowledge that we post up on our website with regards to our brake systems. We try to go through every single feature of every component in the system and do a nice detailed synopsis of why you want this, why this is something that we've engineered into our brake system.
Is it safe to assume that if you're not finding the info you need or you're confused a little bit about it,
give us a call.
You guys have sales engineers that can help you figure out what you need.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah.
No,
and you
no
can
problem.
Do that through email. We have live
chat.
Live chat on the website. You can give us a call. We're happy. You'll never get an automated answer at our facility. We always have a person answer the phone. Most of the time, that person that's answering the phone is going to be extremely knowledgeable. So, we welcome it anytime.
So, all right, everybody, if you like nice competition brake packages and you trust the guys that'll stop NASCAR, I'd suggest taking a look at this stuff. I'm personally looking at it myself, so it's a nice option. And thank you guys for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
I appreciate it, yeah.
Yeah, well, nice. I appreciate you guys hopped on here last minute. We met at the beginning of the show. I'm like, I want to get you on. We had our schedule set, and luckily there was time to squeeze you in this afternoon.
Yeah, no, it worked out perfect.
It was great having you as neighbors here at SEMA.
Yep.
And this is officially the final podcast from SEMA. I got to thank the fine folks at Magnaphone once again for providing the booth space, and Rich Waitis especially. He really, really helps us get this set up every year. It's a mutually beneficial relationship on this. But I can't say enough about how gracious they've been. Magnaphone exhaust products, I've got them on my cars. They are the best. You won't find a better sound.
They've been excellent neighbors, I must say, too, because we had some issues when we first got here. Rich was the first one to come out and try to give us.
He was giving us tools. Great
guy.
Hey,
you gave me a good 10-foot cardboard tube that made running our wires way easier.
Perfect. We're happy to help.
Makeshift conduit.
Yep. There we go.
So, all right, guys. Thanks again. And
appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
This is a wrap on SEMA 2018.